This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Orange County hit the 10,000 case mark for coronavirus this week, but Central Florida health experts say mask mandates may be having an impact on slowing the surge. With July 4th around the corner, city and county leaders have cancelled large-scale fireworks events, keen to avoid the gatherings like Memorial Day that they believe triggered the latest wave of COVID-19 cases. Well, joining me on Intersection to discuss the surge and the response, both in Florida and across the country, Dr. Amish Adalja with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Thank you so much for joining me, Dr. Adalja.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Abe Abarai, 90.7 Health Reporter. Abe, thanks as well.
Thank you.
And you can join the conversation too. What are your concerns and questions about the spike in cases? Do you think the mask mandate is the way to go to stop the spread, or do you think it should be left up to individual choice? You can send us a tweet. We're at WMFE Orlando. Abe, I want to start with you. What do the most recent numbers show us about what's happening in Florida?
Yeah, the numbers that came out this morning are not particularly encouraging. So we had 9,558 positive coronavirus tests on July 1st on yesterday. And so that's really close to the last high water mark, which was last Friday, which was 9,580. So we had a couple of days after that high water mark last week where we were trending down, and unfortunately it seems to be picking back up again. But just as importantly, the percent of positive case has been hovering around 15%, and that's been pretty consistent in the last 2 weeks. And that's a really important metric to look at, because right now, with the percent positive staying about the same, today we saw more test results come in from yesterday, and that percent positive is still too high.
Right, 15% positive is pretty high. I remember just a few weeks ago, we were hearing it was like kind of in the 2-3% range, at least in Orange County, right? So a pretty significant jump there.
Yeah, and statewide, we had a period of time where it was definitely under that 5% range, and Dr. Adalja can speak to this as well. But you know, when you start getting above 15, you know, 5 to 10%, you know, above 5%, not great. Above 10%, you know, that's an indication that the number of tests that are being performed aren't accounting for the spread of the virus, and so without more testing and getting a lower percentage of tests coming back positive, it becomes really difficult to do the contact tracing and quarantining to actually stop the spread. So, you know, this is definitely not a good sign in the last few weeks here.
Well, let's kind of get Dr. Adalja's take on that. I mean, what do you make of that 15%? What should health leaders be doing in Central Florida when we're confronted with these kind of numbers, Dr. Adalja?
You really need to be aggressively going after the cases, and that means case contact tracing, contact investigators, people that are looking at the cases, why they're occurring, looking at the chains of transmission and trying to intervene aggressively, looking at the epidemiology, seeing what is causing people to get infected, what activities are they doing. And I think you've already seen that in Florida with orders regarding bars, where they're actually trying to be very targeted to places where transmission is occurring. But you need to get that down. And the only way you're going to get that down is by aggressive testing, case finding, tracking, isolation, just the basics of public health. That's what that number tells you.
Back to you, Abe. You were reporting earlier this week about the low number of isolation beds in Orange County. So what about those numbers? How are hospitals handling this latest spike?
Well, we are seeing an increase in the number of hospitalizations, and we had gotten to a point earlier in the week where we were down to under 20 isolation beds. And this is, you know, in a county where you've got, you know, 300-400 people who are hospitalized already with COVID-19, and you've got that few number of isolation beds, that's definitely a concerning figure. And you can see it very directly, you know, if you drive by Orlando Regional Medical Center in downtown and you look up at the hospital, it looks like there are, you know, window units in a lot of the windows, and that's because they're retrofitting rooms with negative air pressure, so that they can, you know, have these rooms, you know, be safer and you know, be safer for having patients who are positive with COVID-19 and help control that spread. So right now,
Just for clarity's sake, Abe, negative air pressure means you're blowing air into the room to stop stuff getting out, right?
So think of it like a suction. So if you have a room, the negative air pressure is actually going to be sucking the air in a lot of these retrofitted rooms. It's going to be sucking it out the window.
Okay.
And so that way it's not, you know, going out into the hallway. And to be clear, you know, the number of ICU beds, you know, that's been trending. You know, there are open ICU beds. There are plenty of ventilators from the last look. And we haven't hit the surge capacity yet. So we have not done the things that the hospitals have planned in place to sort of scale up if things go. But at the same time, you know, we're talking about the number of daily test results right now. And these, you know, it's important to note that when you're looking at 9,500 tests that came back yesterday, that doesn't mean that 9,500 people were tested yesterday and came back positive. That means that the Department of Health got 9,500 positive test results delivered to them yesterday. Those
right.
test results have been running 4 to 7 days behind, but because there's been this increase of number of cases and a number of people who are getting tested, you know, we're seeing wait times for some of these labs that are coming back, you know, in the 5 to 10 day range. And so right now, when you're seeing the Orange County Convention Center over, you know, the last week or so setting records most every day of 1,700 tests being performed, those numbers are not yet being reflected in the daily counts yet. So it's, you know, the number of test results lags from the time the tests are taken, and then the hospitalizations lag from that, and then the deaths are the sort of the final lagging indicator. So right now we're seeing the test numbers go up, the hospitalizations are starting to trend up, which is concerning, and, you know, the next logical step is going to be the number of deaths is going to increase as well.
Well, Dr. Adulja, thinking about this from the national perspective, I mean, should folks in Central Florida and I guess statewide be kind of bracing? Should we be bracing ourselves for an even bigger spike in the 5 to 10 day range?
I do think that what's happening when you look at the numbers now is always a kind of a look backwards, that you're not getting real-time information. We know that people are socially interacting, so I do think that you have to prepare for things getting worse before they get better, and that's because there's this lag. There's the incubation period. There's people that are needing to present to the hospital, taking some time to get sick. So all of that incorporates into what to expect in the future. And I do think that for places who have seen increasing percent positivity and increasing hospitalization rates, that's likely to continue for some period of time. It takes a while to get control of these. And I do think this is going to be the new normal in many places in the country, that this is something now that has established itself in the human population. It is not going to go anywhere until we have a vaccine. And the question becomes, how do we keep the cases to a pace that's manageable by health department contact tracing teams as well as by hospitals?
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're with Dr. Amish Adulja with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and 90.7 Health reporter Abab Rai, talking about the surge in coronavirus cases in Florida and what to expect in the next couple weeks. You can join the conversation too. Send us your comments and questions, whether it's about mask wearing or other issues. We're at WMFE Orlando on Twitter. I want to talk a little more about testing, but before we do, let's hear a little bit of tape from the Florida Department of Health's Health Officer for Orange County, Dr. Raul Pino. Here he is speaking at a press conference earlier this week.
What is the point of people getting tested right now when it's taking 9 to 12 days? Should they still be testing? Is that, how important is that?
So I didn't want to answer that one. So, Lauren, that's why I skipped that one. But I have to answer, I guess. Listen, any test is better than no test. That's the truth. And people who are suspected to be in contact with anyone and that has been positive and have developed symptoms should be quarantined and isolated while they are waiting for that test. Now, we know that asymptomatic people have played a role in transmission larger than initially thought, and those people may go around their lives because they are not feeling anything, even when they are getting tested. But my advice to anyone, if you are getting tested because you are suspecting that you acquired the virus or if you are being in contact with someone and you were not wearing protection, or the individual was not wearing protection, hunker down until you get the results. 9 days is not an optimal waiting time for a result. We are fighting to get that into lower numbers. We are going to acquire, we are looking into acquire rapid testing that it only takes 15 minutes in the county to speed this up. But the reality is that results should be as fast as possible, at least 24 to 48 hours, so that we can have a greater impact. And that's the truth.
All right, so that was Dr. Raul Pino we heard there. He's the health officer for the Department of Health in Orange County. And the question, of course, you heard at the start of that was WFTV reporter Lauren Seabrook asking that question in a press conference, I believe, yesterday or earlier in the week. Well, back to you, Abe. I mean, this kind of speaks a little bit to the notion of the high numbers we're seeing now, high as they are, still lagging behind a little bit because it's taken a while for those numbers and those results to be processed, right?
Absolutely. And, Dr. Pino keeps talking about this. The problem with the lagging test results and the increase in testing, the turnaround with it is that, it really doesn't help as far as the contact tracing, to have someone's test results be that old, because at that point they have been, out in the community potentially spreading it for, if they didn't do what he was recommending, which is to sort of self-quarantine while you're waiting your results, if you have reason to believe, then they may have been spreading it already to the community. And, it's worth noting, there's people are waiting in line, an extraordinary amount of time at the convention center to get these tests. I don't think it's reasonable to assume that, these people are waiting in line just because they're anxious and they're seeing the numbers go up and they want a test. I think that it's more likely that, we are seeing people who are waiting in line with symptoms or who have reason to believe they were, exposed to somebody who had COVID-19 or has the symptoms of it and therefore they're worried. So I don't think it's, there's going to be a certain level of people who are going out to get testing that are doing it because they're worried seeing the increases that we're seeing across the state. But at the same time, I think that it's more likely that people are going because the increases is happening and we are seeing more symptoms.
Right. Okay, I want to just get a question in here to Dr. Amish Adalja with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Some of our listeners are kind of curious to know what people should be doing to protect themselves. This week, of course, July 4th, we've got that holiday coming up tomorrow on Friday. Help our listeners gauge the risks. What about a trip to the beach? How risky would that be, Dr. Adalja?
Well, any activity can be more or less risky depending upon how you act when you're in that activity. So if you're going to the beach, it is outdoors, so there's less transmission outdoors. But you need to make sure that you're trying to stay away from other groups of parties that you haven't already mixed with, because it's going to be an opportunity for the virus to spread. So if you can stay 6 feet away from other people, wash your hands a lot, especially when you're touching common touch surfaces, and try and stay away from the dense, more congregated areas, I think you can do that very safely. But the question is, will people actually do that? And I think you find some that do and some that don't based on their individual risk tolerances. But you've got to remember that this virus is going to be with us. It is with us in every activity we do, every time we step out the door. And there's no activity that's going to be risk-free, but you can take steps to try and sort of live with the virus in your presence and try and keep it from infecting you or you infecting others with it.
Okay, so, and we've heard that from a number of people, right from the very top of the CDC all the way down, we just have to figure out how to mitigate the spread of the virus while it's here in the United States and until there's a workable vaccine. But if you do decide to go to the beach, if you do decide to, for example, take a backyard barbecue with some friends and family, what should you do? What are some of the practical things people can be doing to help stop the spread of the virus, protect themselves and others?
Well, first of all, obviously it should be outdoors. You should try and limit the number of people that you're inviting. Maybe you want to invite people as much as you can that you've already mixed with, so that you've already contaminated each other if you were going to, so people that you've been hanging around with. If you are inviting people that you haven't been mixing with, you may want to try and make it very easy to social distance between those people and try and keep people 6 feet apart. You will want to make sure that everybody is washing their hands. You want to be clear to everybody that you're inviting that they should not come if they have any symptoms, even the inkling of a symptom that could be consistent with coronavirus. And you want to also try and maybe avoid people crowding in your backyard as much as possible, trying to keep people as best you can from congregating, maybe at the grill or something like that, trying to just modify the operations to make it enjoyable but yet as safe as possible, knowing that you cannot completely eliminate the risk.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking about the surge in coronavirus cases and the response, both in Florida and across the country. With us on the program this afternoon, Dr. Amish Adalja with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and 90.7 Health reporter Abe Abaraya. Abe and Dr. Adalja, please do stay with us. We'll be right back after this. You're listening to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking about the surge in coronavirus cases across the nation and here in Florida. With us, Dr. Amish Adalja with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and 90.7 Health reporter Abe Abaraya. Dr. Adalja, back to you. The Harvard Global Health Institute launched an interactive map this week that shows the risk of the virus down to the county level in a simple color-coded way. We've got green, yellow, orange, and red. How useful of a tool could this be for the public?
I do think it is useful. We want people to realize that this is kind of a heterogeneous outbreak across the country, meaning certain places are impacted more than others. And people are right now planning travel. They're going on vacations. And I think it's important to have some idea of how likely you are to come into contact with the virus at different places. And this helps people make the decisions that they need to make. And I think this is what we should think about going forward, because this, like I said before, this virus has established itself. It's going to be with us until we have a vaccine. And we're going to see periodic flare-ups in different parts of the country, in different parts of different states. And I think it is important that we kind of think about this as a new normal, as a way that we go forward and try to minimize the risk and minimize the harm that the virus causes. In order to do that, we have to have some idea of where it is and where it isn't and how prevalent it is in those places. And I think that's going to change over time. And I do think this is going to become something that people look at routinely before they take a trip to understand mm-hmm. what's going on. Because I know I'm getting calls from my friends saying, you know, what is it like in this part of this state? And I think having these types of tools makes it much easier to give people solid information.
Do you think there's a risk, though, of people kind of getting overwhelmed by the online tools and the data that's out there? Because there's a lot of maps out there, right? I mean, how do you know which one to look at and what to focus on?
Yeah, I do think it's becoming harder and harder for the general public to keep abreast of what's going on with competing stories that are out there and changing narratives, and as well as new science being discovered on almost a minute-by-minute basis. But it does help in general to have trusted sources of information, and I do think the CDC, the National Institutes of Health, your state and local health departments are trusted sources of health information, and that's only going to make decisions easier. We look at these types of things when we're doing anything. Suppose you're traveling out of the country and you want to know, do you need to take malaria prophylaxis? You go to the CDC travel website and you look at the map and then make a decision with your doctor. And I think this is something that empowers people to be able to do that, because we really need people to take this into their own hands now, because we haven't had strong federal leadership. And this is something now that's part of our lives. So we have to have the tools ready for the general public to be able to take responsible actions. And they need the best information in order to be able to do that. And they can consult, obviously, with other public health authorities as well as their own doctors about these types of decisions. But the more information we have, the better it is, even if it does seem unwieldy at times.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News, talking about the surge in coronavirus cases, what folks can do if they're worried about trying to limit their contact or their exposure to the virus and stop the spread. You can tweet us your questions. We're at WMFE Orlando. And let's get to a couple of audience questions now. Here's one that was emailed into us. Adrienne emailed, "Can I let my two-year-old see her grandparents? They're 58 and 64 years old with some diabetes. If I put her in a preschool program in mid-August and school has COVID protection guidelines in place but no mask use for a two-year-old, or do I have to make a choice between grandparents and school?" Adrienne, thanks for sending us your concern there. Dr. Adalja, that seems to be, I guess, a choice that a lot of people are having to make right now. Like, do you put your kid in school? Do you isolate the elderly folks in your family completely? What are the rules here?
The thing is, there are no rules. That this is really going to be dictated by individual values and individual risk tolerance. And for some grandparents, to them, it's worth the risk to see their grandchildren. And I don't think that we can proscribe that as physicians or public health authorities that's too risky for this individual to do. So I do think that you're going to have to come to terms with this virus is something that we have to contend with all of our activities. And each person is going to have a different risk tolerance. Some people are going to be very risk averse and some people are going to be more risk tolerant. And there are going to be actions and activities and values that people are going to pursue because the benefit outweighs the risk that they see from this virus. And people may make mistakes But I think this is what we're going to have to get used to, is this is something that has to be incorporated into our risk calculation with everything we do. And there's not going to be right or wrong answers all the time or black or white answers. Everything is going to be shades of gray because this is, there's a non-zero risk with anything you do. But you can't expect people to basically put their lives on hold until there is a vaccine because they're going to miss out on their lives. So I think it's important that we not like dogmatically apply social distancing principles to every activity when people's individual preferences and choices are really going to be what's important when they make these decisions about exposing themselves to others.
As well as individual preference, there's also politics thrown in there as well, which can make it a little hard to navigate. We've got a question here from Brandon, who writes in on Twitter, "Mask mandates are essential for the health of the community." This is a comment, rather. "Mask mandates are essential for the health of the community, but President Trump has politicized this pandemic and actively spread conspiracies and called it a hoax. You can tell someone's politics purely if they're wearing a mask or not. They have no empathy." Brandon, thanks for that comment. I do think that's maybe a little bit of a broad brushstroke there, because there is some personal preference that comes into it, and sometimes politics aren't the only thing that are dictating whether somebody wears a mask or not. But Dr. Adulja, does that make it a little more complex, the fact that we do have this fairly highly charged political situation we're in right now? Is it hard to get messages out that people aren't going to see as necessarily political if you're just talking about public health?
That's exactly been the case since the beginning of this pandemic, that politics being injected into it has made every public health pronouncement, any kind of medical advice you give somebody, tainted with the politics of people in Washington that or in state capitals that have really turned what should have been just scientific guidance on what to do, what not to do, into whether or not this fits somebody else's narrative. And I think that's been one of the major downfalls of this pandemic, because so much of the decision-making has been polluted with politicians that you cannot actually, the general public, it's not surprising that they don't trust people, because so much politics is involved there that they don't know if this is supposed to be for them or for the other political party or who's gaining from this. And that's not the way you think about how an infectious disease emergency should be managed. This should be free from politics. This should be free from politicians. It should be the CDC and health department officials talking to the general public, not the president, not the vice president. It should be the CDC director. And I think that we've all for the worse, because the CDC has really been marginalized during this pandemic, and the work of these expert scientists who are the best in the world has been completely decimated because they're so worried about infuriating the president. And that shouldn't be how a scientist approaches this. They should be only dedicated to the scientific pursuit of the truth, not pleasing a politician.
Let's hear a little bit now from Orange County Mayor Jerry Demings. So there is the notion of whether there should be another countywide stay-at-home order. Of course, some folks have been calling for a statewide stay-at-home order as well. Mayor Demings didn't seem supportive of another stay-at-home order, but he did have this to say about businesses who have employees testing positive.
Do I believe that a business should shut down if they reach a certain pinnacle of having positive employees? There's probably something to be said there, that a business should make the appropriate decision, but it depends on the size and the scope of the business, the type of business that they're engaged in, and they'll have to make a corporate decision. If I were a business owner, I would keep in mind that in terms of general liability for the safety and security of your employees and your patrons, there's something to be said about taking appropriate action, as opposed to burying your head in the sand and not paying attention to the safety of others. I expect our businesses to put people over profits.
That's Orange County Mayor Jerry Demings talking about whether or not to impose another shutdown. Abe Arbaria, just sort of thinking about the political will there in Orange County, at least, and of course in other parts of the state as well. What's your sense of whether we could head for another mandated shutdown, whether it's the county level or something a little broader?
Yeah, the difficulty with this is that It's such a difficult decision to weigh shutting down the economy, because there are so many negative consequences, that they're negative health consequences to that when you're shutting down an economy and you're putting people out of work, which can put them out of health insurance, because that's the system we have where our health insurance is tied to employment in many cases. And in addition to that, you've got, the sort of, I don't know how to describe it in the best way here, but it's going to be very difficult to get the political will toward another shutdown if that's what is actually necessary.
Well, Dr. Adalja, what would you say to political leaders who are making these decisions about shutting back down again? I mean, is what we're hearing at the county level in Central Florida kind of replicated in other parts of the country as well?
It is definitely being replicated, and I think it's important to remember that economic shutdowns and stay-at-home orders were never in anybody's playbook. What we had talked about early on when we're thinking about pandemic flu planning was voluntary social distancing. And you have to remember that what happened was January, February, most of March, all that time was squandered in this country where we did not have testing, where we had testing protocols that directed people to only test people from China who had lower respiratory tract infections, letting these mild cases go away. When we know that this virus had been spreading and had moved out of China and was already in Italy by mid-December, was already in France by Christmas, that there was this kind of evasion that this virus was going to come here. And because what ended up happening was you had no way of knowing who was infected and who wasn't infected, that governors felt, because they only had one blunt tool, was an economic shutdown, they enacted them. And I think they were very broad, and they were based on trying to extrapolate what was going on in New York City to the rest of the country, which probably wasn't necessarily a warranted extrapolation. And so that was why we had it. It didn't have to be that way. And now when we move forward, we do have a much better system in place with testing, with hospital capacity, knowledge about the virus. So what we likely will see are targeted, surgical, tactical social distancing recommendations, like what you're seeing in Florida, for example, with bars, or in Texas with bars, looking at the epidemiology of what activities are spreading it, and then targeting those activities, not being blanket. And I think that's the better way to do it, because you can't really, forbid life to the living here when there are certain activities that clearly are contributing to spread and others that are unrelated to it.
We've got a couple of things kind of coming up in just in the minute or so we have left here, Dr. Adalja. But, one big thing that people are looking forward to here in Central Florida is the reopening of Disney World. Some thoughts about, where we might be kind of 10 days from now and what that might mean for some of those long-term plans, or, whether these corporations may need to rethink plans to reopen?
Well, we know that amusement parks are spending a lot of time, a lot of money, talking to consultants, trying to get their parks as safe as possible. But obviously, they're not going to be without risk, and there are only certain things that you can do without basically destroying the experience of being at the park. So these are going to be risky. It's going to be even riskier with the fact that Florida has an increasing percent positivity, which is then prompting other states to put quarantine orders. So if you were to go from New York to Orlando to visit Disney, you would likely have to be put into a 14-day quarantine period when you came back. That's going to be logistically hard for that state to manage. So what you might see is those amusement parks only can really be effectively open to Florida residents, because if they go to another state, those people have to add 2 weeks on to their vacation. So logistically, I think that's really challenging to think about, because until Florida gets this under control, you're going to see states putting restrictions on travel from there, and that's going to make it very hard to get tourists to come to your state, because they can't afford to take another 2 weeks off when they get back.
Mm-hmm. So quite a lot to consider there. Well, Dr. Amish Adalja with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, I do want to thank you very much for joining us on Intersection today.
Thank you for having me.
Abe Abariah, 90.7's health reporter, was joining us as well. Abe, thanks too.
Thank you as well. I appreciate it.
Coming up next, Kyla Coleman with Orlando Citizens Police Review Board joins the program to explain the role of the board and how it could help shape reform. Do stay with us. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Citizens' police review boards are in the headlines as cities grapple with the issue of police reform following the wave of nationwide protests over police brutality and racial injustice. Kyla Coleman with Orlando Citizens' Police Review Board joins the program to explain the role of the board and how it could help shape reform. Kyla Coleman is the Vice Chair of the Citizens' Police Review Board in Orlando. Kyla, thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome.
So for our listeners who may not be that familiar with the work of the review board, give us a synopsis. What is it that you all do?
Pretty much we review any cases that come from internal investigations where there have been complaints against police officers for misconduct or misbehavior. We take a look at those cases after internal investigations has reviewed them to make sure that they did a thorough investigation. And also we give recommendations for policy changes to the police department.
And you meet once a month?
Yes.
Give me a sense of the kinds of cases that you've been dealing with, and you know, do they tend to be the same kinds of cases? Are they like use of force? Is it a real range of things?
Yeah, so it definitely is a range. A lot of times it has been use of force. Sometimes it's the way an officer may conduct themselves to the public, because police officers are supposed to be kind and pleasant towards the public. So we have seen instances where officers were not, and there was a complaint filed and internal investigations had to sanction an officer for that. Specifically today, we dealt with three cases. All three were use of force cases. The first one dealt with a person who had some mental health issues, and the officers did have to fire or shoot towards that person. So we investigated whether or not that was okay for them to do. The second case we had, I believe it was a police officer that had sprayed some chemical spray in order to make a crowd die down of some sort. But typically it's use of force and police misconduct, just their behavior towards people.
Are all of the folks on the review board attorneys like yourself?
No. And that's the thing that I love about it. I am a citizen first who happens to be an attorney. So I'm a citizen of the Paramore community. So it just gives me a little bit more insight that I am an attorney and I know what our rights are just as citizens, period, in the state of Florida. But there, to my understanding, there's no one else who's an attorney on the board right now. I moved to Orlando at the end of 2015. Any city that I move into, I always want to do my best to become a productive member of that community and to give back. So that was one of the reasons why I decided to join the review board. I, as a former public defender, I know that police officers do not get it right 100% of the time. And I wanted to make sure that I was able to utilize my knowledge to help citizens who might not understand, you know, police officers be getting it wrong or might not understand their rights. And this was the best way that I felt I could serve this community.
Are there some cases that you aren't allowed to review? Like, are there some limits to the cases that come before you?
Yes. And that's something that we've recently learned. My understanding when I got onto the board was that we were supposed to review all complaints that came about any police officer. I've since learned that that's not the case. So we are actually going to have a special meeting on policies that need to change within the police department and what cases need to actually come before us. My understanding is that there are several, you know, hundreds of cases that might come through and they select the ones for us to review. But I would like to have more hands-on approach to what cases we review, if not all of them. I feel like anybody who makes a complaint, they should get their due process. They should be able to come before us and for us to review it and make sure that the police officers are behaving appropriately.
So as of now, the process for deciding when the review board gets to see a case, that's up to the police?
Yes, that's up to internal investigations specifically, my understanding.
Okay, and so when you guys take a look at a case, has it already gone through the internal review process with the police, or is it sort of parallel to what they're doing?
No, it's already gone through the internal investigations process all the way through discipline, if there is any discipline that was called for that case.
So given that, Kyla, like, what actually happens to the information that you feed back to the police department then? Like, what do they do with your recommendations if they've already gone through a process themselves?
Right. They're supposed to use the recommendations that we have for future cases. for example, I can't tell you the exact year that I got on the board. It was either the end of 2016 or early 2017. My apologies for not knowing the exact date. But when I came onto the board, I realized that there were not body cameras. They were sporadic with police officers. You didn't know who was going to have it. And I made it my initiative to force the police chief or push the police chief to make sure that every police officer had body cameras, because I was sick of cases coming before us with no video to review. So with that being said, a lot of times we make recommendations to have the body cameras. And for that reason, now the majority of the officers here in Orlando are fitted with body cameras and backup batteries. So that's one of the recommendations that we've made. So I would just roughly say from about 2017 to 2019, it took some years to get that into play. But that is one way that the Police Review Board has influenced the policies of the police department.
And so that's one small step. But is it kind of satisfying to know that you had a hand in bringing about that change?
Absolutely, it is. I mean, because most people are not attorneys. So when I go to court and I have to have a video to review, that's going to help me, because that's the best evidence that you can have is some sort of video. So now I feel like it's helping the city of Orlando, because if you're saying an officer saying one thing, a witness is saying another thing, the video is going to tell the truth, hopefully. Now, there are things that police officers can do, start a body cam, stop it, a battery might die in the middle of it. So there are imperfections with that, but it does feel satisfying to have played a role in at least getting that part of evidence in the hands of the citizens.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kyla Coleman. She is the vice chair of the Citizens Police Review Board in Orlando. Kyla, on the issue of video too, you know, one thing we've seen a lot of in the last few years is, if not it's body camera footage, a lot of times cases get attention because bystanders are taking video, or sometimes it's even the person who is, you know, the subject of the, you know, the police investigation or the arrest or something, that they may be filming, you know, as things are happening. Do you, as part of the review board, do you get to review some of that footage too?
Yes. Yeah, so a lot of times a police officer, if they don't get that footage immediately, like if it's on somebody's cell phone, the officer might take a video of that video with their body cam. I don't know if I'm being clear. Sure. But they would have the video playing and then the officer's body camera would record that. So sometimes we do get a chance to see videos of that nature. But I actually like to see the body cam of the police officer, because I feel like there's a level of integrity that has to be there in order for a police officer to turn on their body camera. So I want to see, okay, is that officer already operating with integrity by turning on their body camera? And then two, are we getting accurate footage?
Now, if we think about the meeting that has just happened, the big news out of that review board meeting this month was Chief Orlando Rolone committing to enacting the 8 Can't Wait campaign. What are some of the things out of that campaign that you think Orlando needs to enact?
Definitely de-escalation. The 3 cases that came before us, pretty much the majority of the board members felt as if those situations could have been de-escalated. And that's where we're seeing a lot of issues, is that officers are pulling out guns, you know, and they're not necessarily killing people, but they're pulling them out and shooting. And you didn't even have to do that. What other steps could have been taken for you to de-escalate that situation and make sure the person is not harmed in their interaction with you? So I don't, you know, I'm becoming familiar myself with the 8 Can't Wait, but my main focus is going to be the de-escalation process.
And I know there are a couple of other things too, like banning chokeholds and requiring a warning before shots are fired, and then
yes,
exhausting those alternatives before a shooting, and also to report all use of force. So quite a list of things there. Is it a win for the review board to have the police chief say, yes, we will commit to that?
I won't call it a win yet, because what I have seen, I mean, Chief Rolone has only been in office for about, I believe he said 18 months. So I do have to give it a chance to play itself out, but I don't want to hear just words. When I actually see actions behind those words, that's when I'll call it a win.
Do you feel like there's a difference between, you know, what folks who are campaigning for change say the Orlando Police Department has done, and then what the mayor and the Orlando Police Department say they've done?
Obviously, there's some sort of disconnect because we had, I think at the height of our meeting today, maybe about 50 or so members of the public that were attending, and they are still very upset. So even though there might have been changes or their changes come into the police department, obviously it's not being communicated to the citizens. So we got to do a better job at making sure that the citizens can actually see what's going on and that it's not just, you know, recitation of what they believe should change or happen.
Now, the police review boards are appointed by the mayor. Do you feel like the board is independent, or could it be more independent?
That was one of my critiques for today, is that we have it on our website as being an independent review board, but we are not. Any evidence that we get comes from the police department. We don't have the power to go back in and subpoena other people, take a testimony or anything like that. So we can't say that we're truly independent, but we can say maybe it's another eye that's on the police department.
Mm-hmm. And across the country, citizens police review boards are, you know, they're more in the spotlight now, but with the discussion around the idea of defunding the police or curtailing some of the powers of law enforcement. What kind of role do you see review boards like Orlando's review board having in that conversation going forward?
I think that may be part of defunding the police, is maybe putting more resources and tools into things like citizens police review boards, giving them more power so that they can have a say on what's going on in the police department. I don't think that it's something that we should get rid of as far as the review boards are concerned, but I think they should just have more power across the country.
And to your point just now about, you know, access to evidence and you know, the kinds of documents and records that you want to see in terms of a case that you're looking at, should the board be able to subpoena officers and records?
I would love to have that power. That's something that I brought up at the meeting today. But apparently, you know, we have to actually change the legislation in Tallahassee, so for the whole state, in order to be able to do that. But I wish that we did have that, you know, power.
Now, when you think about the kind of review board you would like to see in Orlando, is there a city that is a model for that? And can you point to some examples of review boards that are getting it right?
That's something that I'm researching, because from what I've been told and from what other people have been contacting me, they're looking to Orlando. Friends from all across the nation who are wanting to start police review boards or who are already on a review board that has less power than Orlando, they're looking to us. So I read something about Miami's review board and I believe Tampa's. I want to do some more research to see how they operate, because I'm not sure if they're looking at us or if we're trying to model after them. But what I can tell you is that what we do have on our review board is good and it's a start, but I do feel like we can do better.
Do you feel like you've got a pretty good relationship with the police too? Like, are they open to change? Are they kind of willing to do things differently if there are changes that need to happen?
I mean, that's what they say. That is what they're telling us. But like I said, we're under a new chief. So Chief Rolon, I would love to see what actually happens. Under Chief Mina, you know, we saw the body cam definitely change. And that's a blessing and that's a win. But I would just like to see a little bit more with Rolon.
If you're just joining, my guest is Kyla Coleman. She is an attorney. She's also the vice chair of the Citizens Police Review Board in Orlando. Now, one of the questions you asked during the meeting of Orlando Police Chief Orlando Rolon was if he has the ability to hire and fire officers, and his answer basically was yes, he can hire, but there are a lot of steps he has to go through before he can fire. So what is the role of the union contract in that, and is that something you think needs to change as well?
Absolutely. The unions need to change, the Police Officer Bill of Rights, because those are the things that are really holding police officers in place. For example, when we have review board cases and we agree that internal investigations has done something right and that a police officer was misbehaving, it's like a slap in the face when we see that their punishment is maybe an oral reprimand or a written censure, something that's very small. And it's like, man, okay, well, internal investigations got it right, but the discipline doesn't match what this officer has done that was destructive to the community. That's where the unions and the Police Officer Bill of Rights come in. We don't control that. So I feel like those need to be taken a look at as well.
And I mean, can you have some kind of an influence on changing state law? And if so, what would that be in terms of whether it's you or other members of the review board?
I don't know. That's the question that I asked today. We have a city attorney that sits in every meeting, and I posed it to her like, you know, hey, are you going to help us draft legislation so that we can have more power? And essentially she told us that she wouldn't be able to do that. That would be something that we have to do on our own independently of the board, which is something that I'm looking for. To learn how to draft some legislation, because obviously we need review boards, not just in Florida, but nationwide.
Right. Now, you've been involved in the review board for some 4 years now, and it sounds like it's a bit of a learning process for you, but what have you learned about state law, and how eye-opening has that process been?
I think it's a little bit different for me because I'm already an attorney. So I guess I wasn't looking necessarily at how government works, like their specific legal system. I've looked more at our criminal justice system. That's where I have more of my experience. But what I've seen so far is just loopholes in that people themselves don't necessarily understand the different powers that we have as a review board. That's been the most frustrating thing.
What about now, though? I mean, you know, in the last few months, we've seen protests sweeping the nation, every major city in the United States. What do you make of that moment, and what kind of opportunity do you think there is for an organization like a review board to have some leverage and influence some change going forward?
Well, one, you know, it's unfortunate. It wasn't just Mr. Floyd. It's many people that are named and unnamed that have died. And I think that was the driving force behind where we are as a country now. With the review boards, I think that it gives the community a little bit more insight as to what's going on with their individual police departments. For example, in today's meeting, we had three cases, as I stated before. I made sure that each of those cases was read aloud to the public, so that the public could hear the facts, they can know what officers were involved, and they can know what decision came of it and what discipline came of it. So I think these review boards have been around for a while, but it's now catching more traction because now citizens feel like they have a foot in the door to be able to correspond with police officers and to see how it works internally.
Are you optimistic about some positive changes coming about, you know, if not directly as a result of issues that people are raising through the protests in the last month or so, but just in general?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a protester myself. I wouldn't be out there protesting and doing different things if I didn't feel like a change could come from it. I do feel like the United States is at a pivotal point right now where it's either you change or more lives are going to be lost. And unfortunately, the lives that are going to be lost probably will not be citizens. It's going to be a turn against police departments if they don't sit down and start to try to change things for themselves. And I'm not trying to cause, you know, a riot or cause any shock or harm to anyone, but I can just see the way that the wheels are turning right now, especially with the majority of us still being under quarantine and having a lot of time to think about things and a lot of time to act. So it would behoove police departments across the country to start to change and figure out what citizens need.
In the last month or so, too, have you had a lot of inquiries from folks in Orlando saying, look, I really want to get involved. How do I do that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I point them to our website, orlando.gov, because although the Police Citizens Review Board is, I would say, the face of what board you should be on right now, maybe there are several other boards that still have an impact in the city. So they have vacancies and whatnot too. I just would encourage people in general to flood the boards for the city because we need you, whether it's on the police review board or on another board.
Do you have any kind of general advice about what people should be thinking about if they want to get involved, if not on the board in other ways?
Yeah, social media, share articles, share correct articles about things that are going on. If you are living in a specific city where it doesn't have a review board, start a review board. And even if you're not on Orlando's review board per se, still come to the meetings because there's a space for public comment. And we definitely welcome those. You get 5 minutes to speak per person. We will not turn you away. Sometimes we ask for people to get extra time to speak, because we want to hear. I mean, we're representative of the citizens, so who else better to speak for the citizens but themselves?
Well, Kyla Coleman is the vice chair of the Citizens Police Review Board in Orlando. Kyla, thank you so much for your time.
No problem at all.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Production assistance for today's show from Bill Johnson and Abe Abaraya. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find previous episodes on our website, wmfe.org/intersection. When you donate right now to support WMFE, you're making all the news and information you rely on available for everyone free of charge. That service is as important today as ever, and it starts with your gift. Visit WMFE.org to make your contribution, and thanks. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. Thanks for listening.